According to something I heard on the radio, last Friday was National Prosecco Day. Who knew that was a thing? Not me. I don't think my beloved was so surprised, but as far as I can tell, Margie's thought every Friday for the last decade or so was National Prosecco Day, and she and her friends certainly do their bit to support the industry. I predictably failed to do my bit. Sparkling wine is a bit wasted on me. It's a pleasant enough drink if there's nothing better available, but for that sort of money, I could buy several outstanding craft brewed beers and get a great deal more enjoyment out of them. Besides, in the extract we heard tonight from his letter to the Ephesians, the Apostle Paul says, "Do not get drunk on wine, for that is debauchery." But he doesn't say any such thing about beer, and every now and again, a really, really suspect method of biblical interpretation goes in your favor. Which reminds me of a conversation I had the other night with James's wife, Jude. She was telling me about a conversation that she and James had had with some nutter who reckoned that he'd worked out from the Bible and the news exactly when Jesus was coming back. Jude had said to him, "But didn't Jesus say that we can't know the day or the hour?" "Yeah," he replied, "but he didn't say we can't know the month." Funnily enough, you can take the Bible so literally that it becomes absolutely full of holes again. I do want to spend some time looking at Paul's statement about drunkenness tonight, and I'm aiming to do it without resorting to that kind of dubious biblical gymnastics. This letter has a couple of chapters of practical applications towards the end, and we began looking at them last week in that sermon that was 90% introduction. This whole sermon will probably be shorter than the introduction last week. Anyway, the short extract that we heard this week follows straight on from what we heard last week, and I want to focus our consideration of it around Paul's quirky wordplay on the image of drunkenness. Paul writes, "Do not get drunk with wine, for that is debauchery, but be filled with the Spirit." In my paraphrase of the passage, I've rendered it as, "If you're going to get yourselves under the influence, make sure it's the influence of the Spirit and not of the wine." I was endeavoring to highlight the deliberate humor in Paul's words because he's clearly playing with the image of getting full. Or, as we might put it, getting a skinful. He continues his play on images in the following verses, where he uses the idea of singing together to illustrate what he's talking about. He says, "You don't need a skinful of booze to get you singing together. There's another way, a better way." One of the things that I think is really interesting about this play of images is that it's double-edged, goes both ways. It's a bit like you remember those exam questions you used to get where they'd name two things and then ask you to compare and contrast them. Well, this is a similar kind of thing. Paul is not simply setting up two patterns of behavior and contrasting them, one good, one bad. He's calling us to note some similarities as well. We're going to look at the contrasts first, but if you're feeling unsettled that Paul might also be making a positive comparison between drunkenness and spiritual living, just remember, he wasn't the first to do it. Remember what happened on the day of Pentecost? The book of Acts tells us that most of the onlookers thought that the newly spirit-filled believers had just had a skinful of booze. We'll come back to that. The contrast or opposition between a boozy lifestyle and a spirit-filled lifestyle are more familiar to us. In some churches, being a non-drinker is considered to be one of the essential signs of your Christian commitment. The Methodists, the Salvation Army, and in some parts of the world, the Baptists, have all been associated with a strong anti-alcohol stance. It will come to no surprise, as no surprise to you that I don't identify with that view. I enjoy a drink and I enjoy it fairly often, but I still recognize the contrast. The image that Paul is using here is not simply that of drinking, it's that of drunkenness. There are various reasons why some people routinely drink to the point of drunkenness. It produces an altered state of consciousness, which can often be quite pleasurable, at least some of the time. And I guess there are people who get drunk regularly because they enjoy that experience. My observation, though, is that most of the people, certainly most of the older people who regularly get drunk, do so not so much because they like the way it feels, but because they don't like the way they feel the rest of the time. It's an escape, a way out. It's a way of numbing for a while the pressures and pains of a life that is not providing the satisfaction, joy, and fulfillment that we all long for. When life is feeling like a failure, we tend to be less concerned about the consequences of something like drunkenness. It makes us feel a little better for a while. And if things are crap anyway, it can't make it that much worse. Paul begins then by contrasting this with life under the influence of the Holy Spirit. The contrast begins as a continuation of the practical instructions that began in last week's reading. He's urging us to be careful and clear-headed in the way we live. He tells us that we are living in evil times and that we can easily get sucked into wrong things if we don't have our wits about us. Live wisely. Don't do anything stupid, says Paul. There's no one more gullible than a drunk. Their defenses are down, they'll fall for anything. The one thing that most drunks wake up dreading even more than a hangover is hearing what they did the night before. Even if it's not particularly bad, it might still be embarrassing in the cold light of the next day. Back when Acacia was in kindergarten, one of the kinder mums was very funny, even when dead straight sober. And she was from Glasgow, which meant that her accent often made her jokes sound even funnier. And like many Glaswegians, she certainly liked a pint or four. I think she was a parents' committee president or social secretary or something. Anyway, I was picking up Acacia the day after the night of the rowdy kindergarten community trivia night. And I overheard another mum saying to the Glaswegian one, "You were great last night. Your second speech was an absolute cracker." To which she replied, "Oh my fucking God, did I make a second speech?" That dreadful moment when you have no idea what you might have done or said. And it can be a hell of a lot worse than finding out that you made a second and even funnier speech last night. Paul is clearly of the opinion that drunkenness, no matter how good it might feel at the time, is not the pathway to the fullness of life that God desires for us all. To find the pathway of the fullness of the full and limitless life, you'll need to have your wits about you. So the contrast is clear. What about the comparison, though? We're less used to thinking of good Christian living as being anything like habitual drunkenness. But I think Paul is doing this quite deliberately. And I think that perhaps the reason we have trouble with the image is because we've tended to fall into exactly the error that Paul was hoping to get us to avoid. We're so used to thinking of Christianity as very nice and proper and sober and dignified, that Paul was wary that encouraging us to be careful and wise, we might overreact and become stiff and starchy and miserly. Christians can be the ugliest people in the world when they get like that. They become lifeless and life-denying. No, no, no. And Paul is hoping that we won't fall into that. So he sets about counterbalancing his good, sober advice with this image of drunken, disorderly Christian living. His wordplay on getting full suggests that he sees some similarities. Nowadays, he might have alluded to other drugs of choice and encouraged us to get high on the Spirit. Paul draws on the image of alcohol as a social lubricant, as something that enables people to relax and celebrate and enjoy one another's company, and perhaps especially enjoy the company of people that they might not normally be willing to associate with. You know the image. We've all seen groups of people who might otherwise be rather uptight and distant, having a few drinks and then marching down the street arm in arm, singing joyously at the top of their voices. Paul picks up on this idea and suggests that you don't need alcohol to get you singing. Getting high on the Holy Spirit can achieve the same desirable goal. He does suggest that psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs might be an improvement on bawdy drinking songs, but then Luther, Watts, and Wesley all wrote hymns to the tunes of some of the drinking songs of their day. Our hymn Covenant Wine does the same thing with a drinking song from the 60s written by Tom Paxton and then made a hit by the Fireballs. We should have sung it tonight if I'd planned ahead better. Someone, I think it may have been Mark Twain, once said, alcohol doesn't change a person, it just unmasks them. Some drunks are violent, lecherous, and belligerent. Some are pathetic and broken and sad. And some are uninhibitedly joyous, funny, and sociable. And it's clearly this latter group that Paul is holding up for comparison. I remember at my induction service here, Alan Marr preached and told a story of being in Sydney on the night of the Mardi Gras. And he got himself in the wrong place at the wrong time and found himself running into the protest march from the ultra-moralistic Festival of Light. Alan commented that in terms of a spirit of joy, colour, celebration, creativity, maybe even light, the contrast between the two marches, the gay and lesbian Mardi Gras and the dour, predominantly Christian protest, the contrast could not have been more striking. That comment was very much in the spirit of what Paul is saying here. If Christianity seems to be lifeless and starchy, then you're doing it all wrong. We are, after all, followers of Jesus. And Jesus was accused repeatedly of being a drunkard and a glutton. And it's pretty hard to imagine how any starchy teetotaler would ever get themselves accused of that. Not only was Jesus accused of that, but on another occasion, we're told that he produced gallons and gallons of good quality wine at a wedding where everybody had already had an absolute skinful and had drunk the house dry. Total abstinence is a very important and life-saving choice for some people, but it certainly wasn't something that Jesus ever got himself known for or advocated as essential for everybody else. But Paul's point here is not actually about whether you drink or not. There are drinkers who are miserable and judgmental and belligerent. And there are soft drink only people who are joyous and generous and gracious. Those are the kind of differences that matter, not whether you drink or not. Those are the kind of differences that lead us in a pathway of life. Jesus calls us to live life to the full, to love, to share, and celebrate. So lighten up, loosen up. The Spirit of God is poured out. Get a skinful for Jesus.